Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, we're going to talk about The Hobbit Part 1 and Unexpected Journey. We saw it in 3D because we ended up having to sit in a big theater filled with people and listen to that like wave of crunchiness that happens in the first 20 minutes when everyone's eating their snacks.
I almost put something on Facebook about this. I was going to say that the over-under for you to last through a three-hour film, the over-under of how many times you were going to get up to empty your tiny feminine bladder
right.
was going to be like 7.5, and you didn't get up once.
No, you missed it. I got up twice.
Ooh, I did. How did I miss that? I was sitting right where you would have
had. I walked right by you both times and thought you probably saw me and almost expected
that. I thought the person walking past me had a hat on for some reason.
No. Anyway, I also had sneeze.
Well, it was under.
I had a sniffle kind of thing going on.
You definitely did the under.
Not exactly a pleasant experience going into it. I'm not a big 3D guy. Never seen a movie in 3D. Never cared to. This movie kind of affirmed a few things. It wasn't terrible visually from the 3D perspective, but there was a couple times when there was so much action happening that I found that the 3D was more distracting. And it wasn't really that they used it that much. Like the points...
I just don't think it's necessary.
Right, it's not necessary.
It's not necessary.
And there were just points in the story where like there's like a lot of moving pieces, a lot of characters, a lot of everything else. And the 3D doesn't work good with its characters. I thought it maybe looks the best when it's objects or when it's like environments to a degree. But when it's
supposedly
people,
that,
it doesn't
I mean,
look that
I
great.
Didn't see the Avatar in the 3D.
I didn't either.
I'm gonna say the Avatar like David Letterman or something. Did
right.
you see the Avatar,
yeah.
Paul? Did you see the Avatar? I didn't see it in 3D, and I didn't think it looked all that great. I thought it looked very CGI. And I was told by people who didn't even like the movie when they saw it in 3D that it was just breathtaking. So maybe
that would have been the one to see. I missed the ball on that one. Anyway, so you get that out of the way. I was kind of starting in a sort of negative. I forgot about not media blacking out myself 24 hours before, so I caught not any reviews or anything, but I caught like a couple snarky Twitter comments, and then like I caught like the grade on AV Club and was like, okay, I'm going into this already with like kind of
I was getting some backlash also going into
and personally was like almost like it kind of felt like a chore, but I also was like, I'm interested to see this, but here's the thing. Quick little backstory here on this. I saw The Hobbit when I was very, very young.
The Rankin Bass.
Yeah, because it was like some weekend, Friday night thing where, you know, my mom was like out of town, and so it was my dad taking care of us, which happened about five times in my life, whatever. And he rented that, and he was like, oh, I like this story. When I was a kid, I like this, which is weird for him because he doesn't like anything, pretty much. And he showed it to us, and we watched it, and I mean, it has scary moments, and it has, like, adventure moments, and it was really, like, you know, it was really engaging to me. And that cartoon is probably 80 minutes long.
Shorter than that.
Possibly. But
I think they cram it.
I read the book.
The book is not long.
The book is not long either.
Pages.
Right.
160-something pages.
So I'm going into it already thinking, okay, Lord of the Rings is the bigger epic. The Hobbit is a smaller... It's got singing
but
and stuff
it. But it was first.
It was first.
The success
of
his little
right.
Hobbit is what spurred him on. And he went back, and as he was writing Lord of the Rings, he went back and did different editions of The Hobbit, and he tweaked the story every time. He added things.
Okay.
He changed language. He changed...
I'm sure I read that version, yeah.
Right.
Because I
knew
you read
it. You probably read the seventh edition or whatever, the one that's meant to be, you know...
Yeah, because there's definitely, like, the Radagast and all that stuff is in there.
I guess it's 300 pages. I was wrong.
No, but it is a smaller story.
Yes.
And it is a more... I don't know if whimsical is the right word, but it's got the singing. It's got like, a certain sensibility to it. So I'm like... Okay, they're going to go back and they're going to do
not
this.
As
it's going to be
pretentious.
It's going to be.
It's literally about an adventure.
Yeah,
and not about saving
the world,
the entire earth from destruction.
Yeah, yeah. It's a small potentially. So I'm like, okay, they're already going back to do it. Not only has it got a prequel that counts against it because it's like kind of everything you already know is going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
Always the dilemma of prequels.
Right.
But it's a smaller story, so it's not, it just can't be as epic. But then you start hearing things like, okay, it's going to be two movies. And I'm like, oh, I could see it being two movies.
I heard the two, and I was like, yeah, same thing. I was like, okay.
Honestly, if I really think about it, the way that they structured it, the way it could be structured, I could see it being two good-sized movies if they were going to really bolster it. But now it's three, and then I was blown away when I checked it. It was only 2 days ago that I checked at the theater, and I'm like, it's the first part of this story.
It's going to stretch this 300-page book into 9 hours of film.
But here's here's what I've heard, and I don't remember the book well enough, and I could make it through Silmarillion, is that they're actually incorporating a lot of other story stuff into this, which actually happens during the timeline, because Gandalf does leave a lot.
Yes, yes.
So they did a little of that in this movie, and we'll see what they do with the next two.
But here's the thing. With some of it, they just invented it. It wasn't stuff from the appendices or the Silmarillion. Radagast is mentioned once.
Yeah, I know. He's hardly ever... He's not a big deal.
They make a big deal out of him. They give him his own storyline thing, and then they give him a... The AV Club called it the episode one pod race of the film.
Yeah.
Like the super CGI looking...
Yeah.
I give or take that. They straight out invented the guy who's... sworn to chase down Thorin.
Oh, the pale troll.
Azeroth.
Yeah.
The defiler or whatever.
Right, to create a... That seems kind of like, I don't remember any of that.
Anyway, and they pointed out that actually did kind of work and gave some, you know, dramatic...
No, all of it, because without it, it really does become just kind of like a chase movie.
So you can see where some of the inventive stuff they did, but the other stuff is like, you know... a lot of the storyline stuff about stuff is from the Silmarillion, and mentions of elvish stuff is from the Silmarillion, and mentions of other things are from the appendices from Lord of the Rings, not even from The Hobbit.
Yeah, the appendices are crazy.
So all that said, I'm glad that I heard... I'm thinking now that... I mean, you're not going to get so much varying quality out of... Okay, we know what the Lord of the Rings films were.
Yeah.
They were made by the same team of people.
Pretty much, yeah.
This is another movie that's set in the same place with a lot of the same actors.
Yeah, it's all the same stuff.
You shouldn't expect that you're going to get something much different. So you should expect that you're going to get something good. But I think people expected... I don't know if they...
I don't know how you could just please people.
Exactly, because...
Because it's supposed to be a smaller story.
You see the
B
minuses, and you see the... I happen to see... I also tried to black myself out on it, and I happen to see a Rotten Tomatoes score that showed that people were, like... I clicked on something because it was like, yeah, people like The Hobbit, kind of. And I was like, what? Because I just expected it was just going to be as good. And I wasn't as interested because of the three movie thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up being, to me, something that vastly exceeded my expectations, because... The first three, or the Lord of the Rings films, are portentous. And one of the reasons why I like the first one so much is because there's more lighthearted stuff in it, aside from the stuff with the ring wraiths, which is awesome. All that stuff where they knock down the door and they're going through the town. And all that stuff is just great, and it's frightening. But there's also, you do get to see the bright, happy world with the flowers in it in the beginning, and get their camaraderie and friendship and stuff before Frodo is completely weighted down with unbearable woe,
which takes over the entire
third movie.
Oh yeah, and that's in the book too. Like really, you feel it in the book.
And I mean, that's a great job, but it makes it kind of miserable to slog.
Yeah, it's kind of like The Dark Knight Rises. But, it's a tough movie.
But this film, this first Hobbit, is, and I don't use this word, is very fun. It was a very fun adventure to me. And I was, I'm not going to say I was blown away, but my expectations were greatly exceeded. And I am now actually looking forward to how they further stretch out.
Well, I'm curious because they ended...
They're kind of like halfway through the book right
they
now.
They ended pretty much where I expect... Yeah, they ended this where I expected about a halfway point for two movies, which is right after the Goblin King stuff. But like you said, there's not a holy hell of a lot... There's not two movies worth of stuff here. I mean, they're going to get to the Lonely Mountain... Well, actually, you know what? There's all the Mirkwood stuff with the spiders.
Well, here's the thing.
It's the Mirkwood stuff, then it's the Lonely Mountain,
stuff.
And then
there's the Battle of Five Armies. They're going to stretch out the stuff with the men.
Yeah.
They're going to probably... I mean, I don't even know who the actors are who's going to be the men and junk in it. But, I mean, they're going to stretch that out and probably make a movie out of it, right? They're going to introduce them in the second one and do a big deal about it.
The River Men and Dale. Yeah.
And I see how they could do it.
No, I know that, especially if there's other stuff I don't even know, because it's these appendix stuff and the stuff with the Witch King and all that stuff.
Right. And that's another thing.
Necromancer.
So one other thing is to not so much tie it in, but to make you feel part of the fact that this. I mean, another thing in The Hobbit is he didn't have the Sauron stuff. He didn't have the Witch King stuff. He didn't have that a great evil was awakening.
But in those revisions, he adds that.
Oh, sure,
stuff he to a degree
puts a little bit of it back in. But I mean, they really played it up, and it works for the movie. But like you said, with a prequel, you know what happened.
Yeah,
but maybe also that's what lends to it being kind of a fun thing,
right? Yeah, I mean, and here's where I'm coming with it. Because at a certain point, like I said, I went into it kind of with some negativity, and not real major negativity, but just kind of like, this is going to be, especially felt like it was going to be a chore with a whole bunch of other fucking people and with these glasses on my face. And for 3 hours, I was like, I was not keen on the framing device. I thought that it started clunky, and that was a problem for me. The forcing of the old Bilbo and then Frodo, and then having it being set like 5 minutes before the beginning of Lord of the Rings seemed too much. Like, it's like
that,
we're trying really hard to, like,
trying really hard.
That could have
been, and that was really unnecessary.
It was very unnecessary. The more I thought about it, the more I was like, why not just do that at the very end of the third movie? If you want that connection.
So it's like a direct tie-in.
Right. Instead of doing it, because it was really clunky, and then they had to do something that I don't think they did in any other movies, which is they did this 60 years later. I really have a problem with when you have to do that. I mean, the subtitles has existed in the other movies, when they spoke Elvish and stuff. So they did subtitles, but the 60 years later thing to me was like, this is stupid. This is why... Why did you frame it this way? I didn't like the way they framed it. So that screwed me up. Obviously, I had the cartoon and the book. But the cartoon, I think, is just more in my mind because of the nostalgia as a kid. Right. So I knew all the break the plates and all that stuff. And I was kind of waiting for a lot of it to happen with the new stuff. I did end up... Like I said, I used this term before, but it did kind of end up winning me back for the most part. And I definitely would say that I'm excited to see the next two. And I think...
What do you think of Freeman?
Martin Freeman is... it took a second, but I think I ended up liking
it.
It's tricky because of Watson in Sherlock.
It's tricky because of Watson for me. It's tricky because of The Office. It's tricky because everything I've seen of him... I mean, he's himself. You know, most actors are themselves.
Yeah.
But he did really good comedic ticks and touches. The stuff with him smoking the pipe in the beginning when Gandalf comes up. And
yeah, that was good.
He's doing a lot of weird twitchy stuff with his mouth and like... And you could see that, like, you know, he did some actorly stuff with attempting to pull off a little bit of, like, you know, what how do I play a young Ian Holm? You know, like, that's what's hard to do. But
no, he did. There were good things there. I feel like they missed. They could have punctuated the drama a little more to draw him to the adventure.
Sure, and there felt like a few times where they forcefully cut to him looking at something to remind you that he was there.
Right.
But that's kind of how it is in the book, except for he's writing it.
No, right, exactly. And that's the
So how do you show that?
Right, no, that's the other thing is that I watched something or something ahead of time where they talked about... I think Josh was watching it, and it was like some guy's like analyzing the newest trailer. And then, like, so the rock monster thing in the book is probably an elaboration that didn't really happen in the story. Like, it's like him adding it you know, to make it seem more exciting. So the rock monsters are actually in there. And it's clearly, like, just a Universal Ride 3D thing.
I didn't like that part. That part stood out to me in the entire film as...
It also starts
crammed in.
Right, and it starts becoming a problematic for the larger world, too, when you start being like, okay, now we have to reconcile that these kinds of things exist in the world, too, but then they never show up in Lord of the Rings.
Well,
everything else does, you know what I mean? Like, the eagles, all that stuff does.
But they mention giants, and that
they're no longer
around, so maybe these are the last ones, and they just bash their brains in at the same time they happen to be crossing the mountain, and that was the end of them, and they all died.
Yeah. Like, who knows? It's a little clunky, it's a little hokey there. I feel like they did a good job with most of the stuff. I mean, the Thorin character is a little tricky because he's so clearly framed to not be dwarf-like. You know, he
doesn't even look... The rest of them, they make them look very dwarfy. And, like, for instance, Gloin, who's the father of Gimli, looks like Gimli. Like, they make him look like him.
Right.
Many of the guys... Here's one thing that was positive for me about it. I mean, a lot of those... I liked it a lot, but... I saw a book of the art a month ago. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll take a look at this and see what's up. And the photos they had, which were, you know, photos to be taken to be put in magazines and books, of the dwarves looked so ridiculously stupid to me. I was like, the makeup looks terrible. These guys look like a bunch of jokes. It's awful. Plus, for some reason, it bothered me that they were all unknown actors to me. And I know I'd seen some of them here and there and things.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, British things or whatever, and New Zealand things and Australian things. And they all ended up actually being pretty damn good actors. And I think that that kind of more... I never think of Peter Jackson as being an actor's director.
Not really,
but
no.
The performances he's been able to get out of these massive fantasy adventure action films has been pretty impressive, because I mean he knows how to make these, he knows how to make their expressions and everything like to really stand out. The stuff you feel that Galadriel is who she is, and that,
yeah,
and how powerful and mystifying she is. And Ian McKellen is just a great actor. That guy is a fantastic face actor.
Yeah. But what he's doing in this movie was really impressive.
It was really impressive.
If you think about how he had to backtrack.
Oh my god!
He's playing the gray. Yes. He's playing the more befuddled, more not sure of what's going on.
10 years older.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's like 80 something. Yeah. I mean,
I was surprised to see what's his name show up. Saruman.
Oh my gosh, he looked like hell.
I was like, is he still alive?
I thought
is that CG?
I thought at one point he was looking at cue cards to read the lines.
It's very likely.
I mean, I can't believe. Gosh, he's got to be 90 or something.
Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. I was like, I wonder if they're going to throw him in it for 30 seconds.
Yeah, and I heard that they were going to. Yeah, and that was forced in too. He wasn't in The Hobbit.
It seemed like it. Yeah, but I want to say that it's all mentioned either in The Lord of the Rings at some point.
Sure.
Like that's where Gandalf was when he wasn't with them. You know, because he shows up to be like the save the day guy a couple times.
Right.
It's like, where the hell were you the whole time? It's like,
what's funny is that at one point I was bothered by him showing up to be the save the day guy, but those are parts that are literally in the book.
Oh yeah, yeah, no. For
and
sure.
What's funny is that I always remember the troll part as Bilbo
just keeping them up all day,
keeping them up with the talk, which he does. But I always forget that it's actually Gandalf who comes and splits the rock and literally saves them. And I
think that's because in the cartoon they framed it that way. That Gandalf just points out like, now the sun has risen,
right,
and doesn't break the rock. And so in the cartoon it does.
But in the book, the cartoon, Gandalf literally does save them.
Like, oh, yeah.
And he does point out to Thorin that like.
Yeah.
You know, you realize that he was just talking to them forever, so they wouldn't beat you for that whole time.
No, and they do a good job with all that. They have, some of it feels a little like character motivation-y, murky stuff. When Bilbo decides to be the one to go up against that.
Yeah, the stuff
at the end there.
The thing at the end where he does that felt a little bit out of place. It's understandable. I mean, at this point, he'd consigned himself to the idea that he was going to be on this adventure, and they did set up that he wanted to prove
that he
belonged to that part, because they did do enough of that, so that they paid their dues there. To turn every single instance where they meet any sort of new bad guy character into a drawn out fight seemed a little too much to me.
Yeah, and that's where I said, like, with the 3D it was especially annoying,
because like, most of those trolls, they just catch them.
Those fights didn't matter.
The stuff with the goblin den was pretty awesome. I actually thought that was a pretty well directed and
I can see where a lot of people are going to be talking about, like, this is a very fairly, and it's from, there's a degree at which that's measuring with the book too, but you talked about Fellowship, like there's a lot of this is just like boom, ba boom for Fellowship. They go to Rivendell, then they have the cave fight with the monsters,
right.
You know? It's like, and up till before then, they have, you know, they leave the shot. It's very much so derivative of Fellowship in a lot of respects. And I'm okay with that, because I think that for me, the biggest thing is, how are these prequels going to work when the whole thing's done in 6 movies? And I think at some point, thinking about this one, not even when I was done, when it was over, I was like, I think it was Gandalf's performance was key to it, was I was just like, okay, I could see myself sitting down and starting with this movie, you know, and watching all 6 of them, and not having that, like, in the back of my head, like, this is a prequel, they made this out of order. Like, I feel like it would work, it would flow. And that's, I mean, I don't know yet until you have to see the other two, but for me right now, I feel like the entire piece, it seems like they've maintained that so far, at least in this one.
And I also feel like they have also shown us, because they're about adventures that go in different directions and show us different places. They did a good job of that, and it really helps to show how expansive this world actually is.
It does. I always felt indifferent
that in the book was about a particular direction and spent a lot of time in this mountain and then the big valley around outside the mountain where the big final battle goes and all that stuff. And it was different from the stuff in the Lord of the Rings book.
Right.
I always felt like it was a different location. So far, like, it really seems like, and they did a pretty good job about, in terms of landscape, it doesn't look, I mean, it's sure it's New Zealand, a lot of it's CGI, but it doesn't look like the same places. So they did a kind of a good job.
When they want it to, it does.
Sure.
Because they do the troll thing,
yeah.
Which, I mean, I'm sure they must have matched that. Because that's the whole point. The whole joke in Lord of the Rings, they walk by and they see the trolls frozen. Right. They talk about how that area where the ring wraiths come after him, like that was apparently a dangerous place. And that's where, what's his name? The made up scene guy was. But all that stuff, all the Mirkwood stuff in Lonely Mountain is a completely different location. Right. It's all north of Gondor or something.
But getting back to the acting really quickly, the one thing that I always forget about that's considering how fake it really looks at times, but so powerful in the Lord of the Rings films, is how good Andy Serkis is as Gondor.
Oh, right, yeah.
He was phenomenal in this. That was really great. Brief moment. It was actually a pretty good chunk of time, but the brief moment in the span of a 3-hour movie, with him appearing there, like he really was great as that character, and they really do a great job of like letting that guy's face act through CGI. It's really pretty impressive,
right?
And they give a lot of comedy there. Like this movie has a lot more instances for comedy because it's slightly more lighthearted.
It's definitely more
lighthearted. And then you got the dwarves who are actually, they're not presented as bumblers, but when you get to that troll part and they're all wrapped up and stuff, they start saying some pretty funny stuff, and then they're pretty goofy a lot of them the rest of the way. And the comedy basically in the Lord of the Rings movies just kind of fell on Merry and Pippin.
Yeah.
And that got old quick because suddenly they had to be men. And they had to be in battle, and they were no longer.
Well, that will happen in The Hobbit too. When everyone gets to the war, and I remember that in the cartoon, like that's a real. I'll be curious how they approach that, because in the cartoon, it was really a sobering moment when all of these guys, like they had won, like the dragon was dead, and then all of these guys just had this fight, and they all died.
Right.
I mean, all of them, and like Thorin sitting there on his deathbed, and like talking to Bilbo, and it was like, wow, this isn't funny, and I mean, Thorin stayed serious the whole way in the cartoon, and that's just the way he is, and they give you good reasoning for that and good rationale for that. So that's
and they fleshed out semi-bothersome for me in the book was that he was just very single-minded about, I gotta go get my gold. Gotta get my gold, and this, they really made it like,
it's more.
They made it an important thing. You could tell it was. I mean, they kept talking about the home thing. You could see their faces fall when he kind of Freeman offhandedly say, you know, the thing about them not having a home or whatever.
Yeah,
and like you could tell, like it was very important for them. That, like it's more than just the gold, and not only that, but they by giving him the backstory with the other guy, like he's got this lineage to live up to with his grandfather.
Yeah, right.
And
that stuff. I mean, it's all been done before, but it's good. Yeah. I liked it.
So what do you give it? You said missing scene.
I there's a shot in one of the trailers of, it must be Bilbo in Rivendell, where he finds the sword. He encounters the broken sword. I saw it. It's in the trailer. And I don't remember that happening in the movie, unless I had to take a piss break and I missed it. But I don't think I took a piss break during the Rivendell stuff.
So does that mean that...
I don't think he might get back in the third one.
When it comes Blu-ray time, there's going to be extended versions of these 3-hour films.
It's possible.
Like 4-hour long films.
We'll see.
If the third one is at the same ratio as longer.
Let's not even think about it. The third one will be 5 straight hours.
The third one will be at least 3.5 hours. And then the extended version will be something like 4 hours and 23 minutes. It'll be longer than Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet.
Yeah, it's getting there. I don't know. I actually don't know.
Are they going to put an intermission in it?
I think that the third one...
They have to, right?
I think that the third one, even if they cram it as much as they could cram it, is probably only going to be 2 hours long at most. I just don't see it. unless that's just going to be one long battle for 3 hours straight, which will be
Tolkien
crazy.
Did not flesh out his battle scenes to a huge extent. The Helm's Deep one was better for him than the rest of the, than the other books, than what happens in other books. But Jackson was able to take that Helm's Deep thing and turn it into like half of a movie.
Right.
And make inventive things happening constantly. He's going to do the same thing for that. I mean,
it's going to happen.
Think about the potential of what that final battle can be. It's going to be, I think he's going to be pretty impressive.
The only problem is that it's very much so. With Helm's Deep, you had the fact that it was a siege. And so that incorporated a lot of those set pieces. Like, I mean, it's staggered. It's got levels and it's got area. Return of the King, it's mostly open space fight. And same with the Battle of Five Armies. It's open space right in front of the mountain. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's kind of hard to stage anything other than just a Braveheart style. They rush at each other and they're engaged in a field of battle. Which you can have some fun within that and do some things, but that's why Helm's Deep is so awesome. That's, in my opinion, that's the best battle in all of the stuff.
You know what? You know what's great is he's surprised me a few times with this. Jackson has. I know what the places look like in my head.
Yeah.
In the books, and in The Hobbit especially, the thing I always remember from the first time I read the book, and I don't remember how old I was. Was what the cavern looks like where Gollum is.
Oh yeah,
and
described in the book.
When they moved down to it, I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I saw it in my head. And other parts of the other thing, not so much.
I would say with that Gollum thing, I was gonna add, that's a good point. I remember. I mean, I saw the cartoon first.
Yeah.
But
they
then
made it brighter than
that. But then that's what I was gonna say in this movie in The Hobbit, it's
pretty well lit.
Way too bright. I mean, the whole point is that
the book made it sound like
he's literally in the dark. Yeah, you pretty much can't, and that's why it's way scarier and creepier.
Absolutely,
and just the idea that, like, you find this monster down there that's like, then you're going to play a game with it to try to survive, and the finding of the ring.
The creepy thing about Gollum is that he's fully capable of murder and horror, but he's like a retarded child, kind of.
Well, he's got the double personality thing. He's got the, like, completely obsessed with the ring, evil, and then he's got, like, the I'm just a guy that doesn't want to, whatever. Anyway, yeah, so that's kind of a petty thing, but I guess I would say visually, it didn't kill me. Like, let's talk about 48 frames a second looking like video, blah, blah, blah. That didn't bother me or whatever.
That wasn't a theater that showed it.
I'm glad for that. Then
it looked fine there. I didn't see
it. Yeah, I know. So I'm saying that comment, but I think that it maybe was a little overlit in some places.
It was overlit for sure.
It didn't ruin it.
But
for
you know
me
what?
Whatever. But
they had to have made an active attempt to do that, because if you think about it, considering these are PG-13 films that they want everyone to see to make a massive amount of money. If you really darkened this stuff to the point where it's really talked about in a lot of the books, like it would be really dire, dark, frightening, nightmare-inducing stuff for children.
It would
the stuff where Shelob, the spider, comes down in the third one, I guess. Like the beginning of the third one, where
it's the end of the second one with the Shelobs. They changed it for the movie. They moved her to the beginning of the third movie. That was a few things that they actually shifted.
I saw kids crying and stuff in the theater. I saw that one with a bunch of my friends, and my friend B's massive was sitting in front of me, and he's got a thing about spiders, and the thing came down, and he goes and like sinks really low in his seat, and he was like terrified by that, and there were kids like
right well people
crying,
had
their mom's
phobias and stuff
and it was like, and that was like a darker shot, and like by then it was already. Portentous and weighty and dark on Frodo and geez, like,
no, I hear you. I mean, that's going to happen
stuff
in these too.
Heavy,
it's going to get that way to a degree. I would say, I don't know, man. It was weird. I just was in a mood about things, and at one point I was like, this is probably a 3 out of 5. But as it kept going, I think right now I don't know where I'm at. I'm at that weird nebulous phase of 3.5 to 4 because it's part of a whole, you know?
They credited
Guillermo del Toro?
No, they credited who plays Smaug. It's Cumberbatch. He didn't say a word.
Oh,
I don't think he made a noise.
Or yeah, something like that.
You think that's him doing that, or they just got some Foley dude?
Why would they not get him to do it when he's in this booth? He's in the booth paying him.
He was credited. He didn't. I don't think he even made a single noise that came from.
I like that they didn't show much of Smaug, because yeah. I was like, that's got to be the big draw for the next movie or whatever. Right. Though I'm not sure.
It always bothered me when I was younger that you could have a great and fearsome dragon as the bad guy in the first one, and then in the second one you wouldn't have any, or in the Lord of the Rings series you wouldn't have any.
But
in the Silmarillion, they actually explained that there were ever only like four or five great drakes, as they call them.
Yeah.
And they were all killed by one thing or another, and Smaug was like the last of them, and was the greatest and most fearsome of them for whatever reason. And they had different abilities. One of them had no wings, and one of them couldn't do fire, and one of them did this, they were like created by, I mean, in the whole mythology of the thing, they were created by the evil god, the fill-in for Satan, who...
Right, okay, so yeah. It was Iluvatar as god.
Right.
And, I used to know the name. It's a great name. It's
created
a great
powers
name.
To the angel characters directly below him.
Right.
And those ones...
And yeah, it's basically that. Yeah,
the planting one of them
became Satan, and I forget the name of that one, but he has it's a great name.
One thing that really separates, I'll give him that. It really separates the way that the two movie series now will work is that Frodo is this gentle-hearted, extremely kind, not talkative, just person who feels like he has to do this, and he's Bilbo is more of a personality.
Yeah.
But it's not like that puts Frodo in negative light. They even get like a very soft, gentle actor to play him. Like,
yeah.
Unless you count like Sin City, which is just creepy, but, and then in the case of Bilbo, like he is a talkative, almost trickster, but he's got a good heart, and he's very interested in, one thing that I actually like about Ian Holm playing it, his acting in the first series, was that if you watch any movie with Ian Holm in it, except for maybe The Fifth Element, he's very particular and deliberate in his movement, and moves slowly, speaks slowly, very assured.
Very buttoned up in most
of
the stuff.
And he is so twitchy and peppery in the Lord of the Rings films and in Fifth Element. He's like very nervous and...
Yeah, right.
Oh, he's constantly crossing himself and moving things and flipping out.
Turning
and
his back.
Fainting and he's a very good actor. I think Ian Holm is a very good actor. Have you ever seen The Suite Hereafter?
No.
That's a great movie. The Adam Egoyan films are really good. I highly recommend the people that...
But he does do the twitchy, like, he plays the character that's been affected by this ring, like, So there's definitely an arc there to have happen, I guess. But it will be, I'm just so nervous that it's going to just be bloated. And that was the biggest I remember back in the Roper and Ebert days. That Roper didn't like The Lord of the Rings. And the only thing that he could say, like on Leno one time, maybe it's because he didn't have any real time, but like Ebert liked him or whatever, and Roper was just like, they're too long. And it's just like
that
alone is not enough of a reason to dislike.
It's not enough, but I can appreciate that, and that will.
I can hear you.
That will make me not want to watch something again.
I get you.
And in retrospect, that might make me think of the thing I already saw and enjoyed lesser.
Yeah, like that was good, but it wasn't worth that much time.
And then if I think about watching it, I'm like, I'm not going to watch that again. So maybe it wasn't that good. Maybe I was wrong. It's not meant to be that sort of thing.
And I'm thinking about it too, and I'm like,
you love Heat. I liked Heat a lot when I saw it. I really don't want to watch Heat again.
Here's the only thing I can think of about
it's
that.
A little lengthy.
No, right. But and it is a tricky plan. First off, you have to have: are you a kind of person that does rewatch stuff?
I rewatch stuff constantly.
Me too. For certain things, I've tried in the last year and a half.
I literally watch Commando.
No,
many times as it's on in a row.
I love it.
So you're saying that the requirement for watching Heat?
No. So it's a tricky thing when you think about like so many things you haven't seen, and then you're rewatching something because you do like it, and it's nice because like there's the reliability of knowing what you're gonna get. and knowing right. you're in the mood for it. But nothing is better, obviously, than loving the first experience of watching something, which is difficult because you have to get kind of this weird self-aware. I've had it happen a few times, like a couple of shows or something, and it's great if it's a show.
It has to surprise me for that to happen.
Right. No, it has to surprise you, but like to me, it has to surprise me, but also like, give me a sense of like, okay, I can kind of know what to expect to a degree. So that
if I know that I'm going to expect something awesome, that's great.
Yeah.
But let me give you an example. The year of the film, 2007, one that I always brought up that no one seemed to like as much as me was Gone Baby Gone. I've seen it again. It wasn't as good. The experience of seeing it the first time.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
The stuff that happens at the end of it lifts the entire film up to this level that surprised and astonished me, yeah. and I thought was just phenomenal, dramatic character. You know, this guy basically leaves his life out to dry because of the moral decision he made,
mm-hmm.
that he was not for anybody, including the love of his life girl. They'd both been abused as kids, whatever, and dealt with this whole thing coming up there. He wasn't even going to tweak what he felt was right by whatever weird sense. It wasn't helping the girl out. She was going to be with a happy family.
Yeah. Well,
he did what was right by the very sense of the word. And then at the end, he's left hanging out to dry because her piece of shit mom goes out to go party again. So he's stuck babysitting the girl he saved. Like that was so powerful to me. And it blew me away because I didn't know that was coming.
No, I hear you.
It's not like a Shyamalan twist.
No, no.
It was like this unbelievable stand taken by a character.
Right.
Not that you didn't necessarily see coming, but you didn't think he would make.
No, I hear you.
That experience to me made elevated that.
And that's the angle on a lot of these things. But in terms of, and I have a different experience than you, obviously. Yeah, you've got less time than me. But it kind of comes down to, like, I'm sitting there like, I've done them once. I've done, since I've had all three of the Lord of the Rings movies, mm-hmm. Seth and I did like one Christmas, like we watched
Extended.
Yeah, we watched Fellowship on Christmas Eve and then Two Towers on Christmas Eve night, because mm-hmm. it's a good one to watch at night, you know, for obvious reasons, because it's mostly at night. And then we watched Return, which is the longer one, like during Christmas Day. And it was like, it's a good, like, that's a Christmas marathon every 5 years kind of thing. I could see, and I'll probably hold off on that again. So now I'm scratching my head with these other ones. And I'm like, I don't know, like, this is not something to sit down and do in one sitting. Like, now it's like something you'd stretch over like a couple of weeks. And honestly,
you're talking about 20 hours of movie there.
Yeah, right. And so that's the control you do have with things like that. So yes, length is an issue, and like with TV shows and stuff, but you can kind of police it yourself. You know, like I've watched Battlestar Galactica, the TV show, like 2.5 times, and that's a whole TV show. That's a lot of hours, but I like it enough. And you know, if I watch 2 or 3 episodes on a Friday night, and I'm just like, that's just the show I'm going to watch because there's not that many other good TV shows. I mean, there's maybe 4 good TV shows on in a given round of stuff every 3 weeks.
Sure.
And you can watch that stuff pretty quick or not watch it or wait for it to be a DVD and marathon a season of it, you know. With some shows, I'd prefer that maybe. So there is a way to kind of blend it all out and schedule it. It really just comes down to if you get this mentality of like, I want to consume all of this one thing now, then yes, you're overwhelmed. You're not going to do all the Lord of the Rings movies.
I know at one point that I did have more time. I had a great deal more
time. You'll have more time in 20 years.
No, but listen. 20
years.
What I'm trying to say is I know that at one point I had more time, but I still don't understand how I ever decided that I was going to watch the extended versions of Lord of the Rings on DVD. I think I've seen them 3 times now.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know where I ever decided. I've like you were just saying, I felt the urge to watch them, and so I watched them. And I didn't do it in a row. I watched one, and a couple nights later, I watched another one, and I maybe stop it halfway through and finish that the next night, and I watched the third one and stop that. You know, but that was at a time where I did have more time. But I could have been spending that time doing other things that I probably found more enjoyable at the moment. I know that every time I've watched the third one, at some point I'm just feeling dragged down by it. And I feel that way. The ultimate film in a trilogy
is usually the middle one. It is.
I meant Ultimate in a literal sense. Oh. The last film of a trilogy ends up being, in all cases that I can ever think about, something that you generally have to slog through to get to the expected ending.
Yeah.
The second ones always intrigue me because they do different things in them. I don't know why I'm thinking about the Matrix trilogy right now. The second one is a very odd film. It's got some very interesting action set pieces and very quirky philosophical talks to it. The third one was a slog to me. The third Lord of the Rings is mostly a slog to me to get to where you expect it to get.
I agree.
To end. Return of the Jedi is a major slog for me. There's some awesome stuff in the beginning. I love the beginning of the film. The first act is phenomenal. And then bits and pieces of the circling around the various players going through the story to the rest of it are interesting to me. I can't stand the Luke garbage. I really don't like... the stuff that's happening in space is almost irrelevant. I like Han Solo. But they're, you know, the interesting stuff they're doing out there in the woods is also happening with teddy bears.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a little bit of a drawback to that also. It's not like they're bad films. They're you know, none of those are really essentially bad films. I don't even think the third Matrix is particularly bad in any way. It's just like when you decide to make a trilogy.
It's the dilemma of a trilogy. It's the dilemma of any story.
You have to make it go down into the mire so far that you can barely see the light of day for the main character to reach up and somehow grasp the thing that pulls everyone out of it.
Yeah.
And so you have to just sink everybody who's watching it into the depths of despair. And not only that, but you have to draw it out because you can't have it happen quick. And that's a trilogy where the stories are meant to go together. A trilogy like the Alien trilogy or Die Hard trilogy are separate films.
Yeah.
Each one is a
standalone.
That's a
different system.
That's different, and that works fine. That's great. But when it's three stories going to the same thing, the arc is like, oh, we're having some fun. Oh, it's getting crappy.
Yeah.
And the second one's like, oh, this is rocky terrain. Then the third one just bottoms out and just falls off a cliff.
I'll probably like the second Hobbit movie better than the first one, and probably dislike the third one more than the first.
Yeah.
And that's usually the trilogy flow. I've heard some people that I think most of the guys on Film Junk prefer Fellowship.
I prefer Fellowship. I really do. I like the Two Towers a lot.
I can see that, and
I just feel like everything that's outside of the Helm's Deep stuff is kind of forgettable in that film.
There's a degree which that's true, yeah. I think just as a kid, when I was reading the books, I was so engaged.
That was the best part of the books, for sure.
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, to me, that's still translated in the movie. Like, it really is what you get with a trilogy like that. And that's another part. If you talk about the slogging, if you look at it like a dramatic intensity thing, by and large, you're right, you don't get maybe your biggest moment in part two of a trilogy, but you do kind of get the peak of the intensity to a degree, where the most craziest is happening. Nothing has been resolved at all. None of the subplots. The most subplots are running. The most parts.
Usually, the main party or group or
is divided as much as it's going to be.
Is divided or has taken heavy losses, but barely is still barely hanging
and
on.
It's divided as much as it could be.
But you have to end a third thing with anything like that with an even a just as big or even bigger battle.
Yeah.
So. The almost forcing that is what it feels like in everything.
Return
of the Jedi is not so much forcing it because, like, it's happening on so many different scales.
Yeah.
It's happening on this planet where this thing is intended
to be. Teddy bears.
It's happening on the Death Star. It's happening in space in a massive
sense. Feel like the Return of the Jedi one is actually pretty effective.
It's effective. It still doesn't erase the slog for me.
The fight between Luke and Vader is a different kind of fight in that, and it's not good looking as
it's
Empire.
Dragged out.
The Empire fight is
awesome.
The best lightsaber fight in any of the Star Wars movies.
A first movie is generally made with the idea that, like, listen, we could never make any of these again, so we'll have
anymore. Now things are planned for trilogies.
But in these, it's like at the end, things are kind of looking up of the first one because this person discovered their powers or found out who they are or figured out how things work. The second one is...
You got to knock them down a peg.
...constantly being beat down by the reality of the situation. So they're really never getting a leg up on anything. And that's the way that the Empire Strikes Back works.
Absolutely.
Is that just the fact that he's a Jedi doesn't make him do anything. He gets the hell beat out of him in Hoth. Right.
Yeah.
And then he gets the hell beat out of him by Yoda, and he doesn't figure anything out by there, and Yoda's like, don't leave, dude. And he's like, I gotta go. And then he goes and gets his arm chopped off.
Yeah. It's like, ideal.
He just gets beaten down constantly. Yeah. And none of them get anything good happen to them. It's not a dark film.
It's a pretty dark film.
It's not a dark film, though. It's just where the bad stuff happens.
Okay.
You know?
Fine. I'll give you that. But anyway, yes, that is
the dark stuff at the end is in a nice, clean city in the clouds. 4 out of 5 is very good score for me for a film.
Yeah.
Once again, you're doing the thing where you sound like you're going to talk about something negatively, and you give negative points, and you're like, oh, I'm about this film. And at the end, you give a score that's higher than what you talked about. You realize you just did that again.
I don't think necessarily. What did I say that was so negative? I said it was a little overlit.
I agreed
with all of your positives.
You just never got really happy about the film.
I don't know. That's true.
Four out of five is a happy film.
I don't get very happy about things. By the end of the movie, I was happy.